Looks like she has a date. Bald guy with hooded eyes and Halloween wax lips. She looks happy, flashing her fluorescent smile. Kids kick soccer balls against the wall of the church. Candles extinguish in the windows, and some have closed the shutters as the bells strike midnight. Chris reverts to Fresno disco dances with Violetta and Aneta. I overhear snatches of Julia and Hugh deep in conversation about Turkish food. Eugenio's wife, pregnant again, sits stonily as he wows everyone he dances with. For some, the night is young. For us, time to go home. Let us come back, I say to the billowing skirts of the Madonna as she disappears into the sky. Leap before you look. The fact of Cinque Terre is the sea. Marled swirls of clear turquoise to blue waters. Camille prefers Cornelia over the other Cinque Terre towns. Wedged above the sea, the village looks from a distance like an opened pan of watercolor paints, blotchy rectangles of aqua, copper, pink, rose gold, pomegranate, cream, stacked upside hills of grapevines. Yesterday, Susan drove Nicola's Land Rover, the Fiat way too small with me, Lauro, and all the baby paraphernalia. Hugh stayed at the villa. We dropped the car at the station and hauled all the stuff onto the local train that plies the villages. What a fiasco, juggling the portable bed, the stroller, the bags, etc., etc. And Lauro can wail. Everyone packed lightly, as there is nothing to do at the Five Lands other than hike, walk, swim, eat. Of course, Susan's here to check on Nicola and Brian's future rental, an independent white house with wraparound views. The rest of us tag along. Julia's birthday, number 60, is on Friday, so we're lugging gifts for her as well. From the train, getting to the house, we had to climb hundreds of steps dragging everything. We were panting at the door. Inside, instant balm. Susan opened all the glass doors, letting in the sea air and views of blue, blue, and more blue. Nicola's cleaning woman stocked the fridge with basics. Soon we're on the terrace with an icy pitcher of a blood orange drink that came in a Tetra pack, but tastes delicious. Susan holds up Lauro for his first view of the sea. Camille breaks into Eddystone Light, a camp song everyone knew but me. By the time I went to camp, we were singing Stayin' Alive. What provoked Eddystone was a verse about the father falling in love with a mermaid. Looking at these limpid waters and gnarly rocks, you believe they slither up to comb their tresses. Because I've been here before, and Lauro gets heavy, I want to forego hiking and to take this time to write. Although there are level stretches, inevitably you meet steep inclines, stairs, and unfortunately at this time of year, crowds, too many people. We're crazy to be here at the end of August. Thank you, Nicola and Brian. A quiet house, away from the fray. Camille and Susan trek out early. When Camille decides to find a local cafe and read, Susan heads on toward Vernazza. Rowan's new project with the poet gave Camille the idea of making paintings inspired by Italian writers. I told her that Eugenio Montale had a house in Monterasso. She wants to spend a couple of hours reading his poems about Cinque Terre. Is she going to find only sea views and flowers? Well, maybe that would be fun to try, spontaneous sketches in red chalk or ink. Meanwhile, she has an almond pastry and cappuccino, the book open, her gaze drawn out to sea. She thinks of October, when the lease expires on Villa Assunta. She imagines packing her clothes, dismantling her studio and Limonaia workroom, saying goodbye around San Rocco. The puzzled looks from Violetta and Stefano, Leo and Aneta throwing a final dinner, a farewell lunch with Mathilde. Home to Carolina. Oh, let Charlie stay in the big house. He has workspace there, his uptight wife is happier, and Ingrid has space to breathe when things are tense, which Camille suspects might be often. Ingrid is studying Latin. Camille can take her on tours of Rome in the summers. One of those end units at Cornwallis, with corner views and a porch with a swing, now that we've had our fun. Charlie and family coming for the chef's Sunday brunch? Rowan? He'll come to see her. They'll meet in Istanbul or San Francisco or... where? Copenhagen. She has not seen Scandinavia. She tries to focus on the poems. They're elusive. Reading them feels like socking a pillow. Who's in them? There are no people. Only nuances of some you who begins to seem like the poet himself. Camille sighs and comes up short. Now that we've had our fun? She hears herself thinking that. Our fun? I've been asked to exhibit by important museums, and I call that my fun? Must I always pull back into some I don't deserve corner? She bites her thumb knuckle. I deserve to give up my house and move to a corner unit on the, what did they laugh about? The luxury cruise down the River Styx? I am stupido! The waiter smacks down the check. Is she taking the table for too long? She stares up at him angrily, orders another coffee, and stuffs the Montale book in her bag. She remembers sensuous Keats from Ode to a Nightingale. Oh, for a beaker full of the warm south. The longing, a big swallow of time and place and heat. That's what today feels like. End of August sun bearing down on one of the most enchanting places on the globe. Multitudes, many on their phones, oblivious, surging down the streets and paths. No wonder Montale floated above them, she thinks, and focused his attention on cicadas and tamarisk trees and sunflowers. Flushed and sweaty, Susan doubles back to the cafe and orders a large beer. Great place to hike, great! But we're not the first to think of coming here. The trails are crowded, it's like a forced march. We have to come back in April or November. She takes wipes from her fanny pack and swabs off her face and neck. Let's get back to the house. They're charged with picking up ingredients for dinner. Tonight will be fun for Julia. Camille says, gathering her bags, with a basket of what's just caught from the fishmonger. Maybe he'll have some of those razor clams. Where is Julia? I think she was going to the beach in Monterasso. She's still reeling, you know. Yes, she's better. Everything that was suddenly turned upside down and shook out. And it's real. Did you see the photos Liz just sent of the three gray vases she made? There's talent. I'd love to have a few for the villa. Ah, wonder if I could commission a couple. Not gray. A sage green looks pretty with any flower. They should have grocery delivery by drone here. They're hoisting two bags each. Wouldn't that just work? The sky's as crowded as the streets. Julia takes the train to the beach at Monterasso. She finds a spot for her towel. A couple of women who would be in cover-ups at home lounge in their two-piece suits on plastic chairs next to her. One on her phone, the other knitting. Julia sits down and rubs sunblock on her nose. The knitting woman asks where she's from, and they chat for a few minutes. They are two widows from Viterbo. When Julia decides to swim, she asks them to keep an eye on her phone and bag. From all the bodies sprawled on beach chairs and the sand, she is afraid the sea will be warm. But no, the water feels luxurious and fresh. She swims out beyond children and the ones cooling up to their waists. Only cold salt water can instantly infuse such a great rush of energy. She's a natural in the water, having grown up with summers on Tybee, a sailboat, and camp swim teams. She remembers the pride of receiving the junior life-saving badge from the Red Cross, a medallion her mother sewed on her swimsuit. She flips and surfaces like a seal. To somersault, backstroke, kick, to bind yourself tightly to yourself and roll on top of the water. This is a joy we were born for. Fresh and deep, the water limpid, unlike the turbulent blue-gray Atlantic she loves, with the wild surf and the hard sucking undertow she was warned against, it seems, on the day she was born. She practices the side stroke, her mother's preferred way to swim, remembering summers with her parents. Cleve always up for racing into the waves, letting the cresting foam smack them down over and over, taking off his suit underwater and rinsing out the sand, bouncing her on his shoulders, running up a beach white as flour, Julia wrapped in a big towel, shivering. Treading, Julia sees tall rocks rise abruptly to the left. A boy, poised at the top, leaps, plunging into the water that must be 40 or 50 feet below. She wades into shore and shades her eyes. Another boy stands on top, looking down, his two friends urging him to jump. He's shaking his head, backing up. How high is that cliff? Julia walks over to the path up. A girl of about 16 in an ounce of fabric scrambles up just ahead of her. Are you going to jump? Julia asks. Yes, it looks so fun. Are you? No, I'm just going up to see what it's like. This would never, ever be allowed in the U.S., Julia thinks. But here people make their own fates. Julia scrapes her knee on the rocks, looks down, already dizzying. At the top, four kids are standing around, working up their courage. One says, "You have to leap way out." From above, the water is dazzlingly blue. If you jump and you're not lucky, you could bust your head like a watermelon falling off a speeding truck. Julia creeps up to the edge. How sublime the water looks. Limpid, clear to the bottom. Fear rises in her like thermometer mercury from a feverish child. The girl who said it would be fun to jump backs off after looking down. One boy goes, arms flailing. Just to test, Julia steps to the edge. She looks down at the small figures on the beach, out at the horizon. "Via, via," one of the boys says. "Go, go." She feels a quick shock of surprise. She rises on her toes and jumps. Camille and Susan find little new potatoes, huge, juicy tomatoes, lustrous black eggplants to roast with peppers. Last, they pick up sorbet. Tonight, they get to stay home. The wine is a pain to lug back to the house, but they manage everything, plus a jug of fresh orange juice and a bag of lemons. Walking back, Camille says to Susan, "I've been sitting on that stupendous terrace, imagining going back home in October. What that would be like." "Are you crazy? I'm not going anywhere. This is home now. My life is much more interesting than I could have imagined. We have fabulous friends. Look what happened to you here. Italy. Tonight we should talk, really talk." Susan has been searching online at comps for her house in Chapel Hill. Her girls agreed when she sold the beach house. But would they want to give up the house where they were raised? They love coming home to pound cake, peanut butter cookies, dinners on the screened porch, their rooms, one blue, one yellow. Even so, if Susan stays, they'll love coming to Italy probably more. The new replacing nostalgia for the old. They're in China now. No one yet has responded to the large ad they placed in the newspaper with the earliest photos of themselves, dates, where they were found, and the name of the orphanage, which still exists but will not release further information. Susan doubts they have any, since they did not at the times of the adoptions. Eva was left on a bus, Caroline outside a shrine. Both had their birth dates pinned to their blankets. Susan has always imagined the mothers writing those dates, preparing to leave the house. Imagined them at the moments of abandonment, fleeing the scene, what she must have felt. A crazed relief? If Eva and Caroline find out anything, it will be subject to DNA testing. How amazing if they locate some wide-eyed, tragic parents. Do people who abandon children out of whatever desperation come forth because of an ad? Can they read? Wouldn't the shame keep them silent? Huge random chance, statistically against the girls. She thinks of their rooms, intact since college, the canopy beds from her grandmother's house, a southern heritage tacked onto their origins, of their minimalist apartments in California, their devotion to their jobs, and each other. No other relationships seem to arise. A puzzling fact, but Susan can't intrude on their privacy. She stares out to sea. She's their mother. Susan could sell her home, buy a small condo for visits. She remembers the man with narcolepsy, the willowy Catherine who planned to leave the North. Why buy anything? Why not cut the cord? If she wants to go back, she can rent a temporary base. Bridges have burned. Lauro likes it here. Who wouldn't? The breeze makes you want to say halcyon. He's peaceful, knocked out after nursing, a milky haze descending as he nods off. I parked him under a purple passion vine, a live mobile, while I worked, moving from one project to the other all day, pausing only for cheese and fruit. Meriggiare, to rest in shade on a hot day. Nicola has an enticing rental. At least the basic furniture is colorful. Sparseness suits Cinque Terre, where delivery of heavy items must be a nightmare. Susan plans to rearrange beds to capitalize on the views and to recommend updating the tiny showers and 70s kitchen. More tumbling vines and pots of herbs. We're all happy here. Such simplicity gives the feeling of unburdening. Blue is good for the soul. Florida girl, I'm always best when I can see open waters. Julia returns last. Susan and Camille lugged food up all those steps and decided to read in their rooms, I suspect they are sleeping. Julia opens the fridge and takes out melon and cheese and a leg of the roast chicken we had last night. I'm famished, she says, bringing a plate out to the terrace. Her hair hangs in salt-dried clumps, her shoulders the color of plums, painfully blistered. I offer some after-sun lotion. I'm fine, thanks. I think I fell asleep on the beach for a few minutes. You won't believe what I did, but I'll tell everyone later. She falls on the chicken, smiling and licking her fingers. This is good, good. Want some? She spears another piece. What I need is a shower and a nap. Something good happened to me today. I'll not only tell you, I'll show you. How is our sweetie over there? Lauro makes little sounds as though he's talking back to the mourning doves that coo in the pergola next door. The woman there sunbathes nude. Through the grapevines, I can't help but glimpse her impressive breasts like two rounds of pizza dough rising. A bit surreal. I just hope she doesn't burn into the color of a sweet potato. Her husband, clothed, reads the newspaper, then lets it drop over his face when he falls into a snoring sleep. Part of the panorama. Julia and I giggle. Why is snoring always funny? Is he lying at the opening of the cave, scaring away bears? Below us, a woman hangs out wash, flowered sheets fluttering. This village is a hive, each house a honeyed cell. Julia keeps it simple. She's the maestro, directing Susan to sauté the potatoes, me to set the terrace table. Let's hope our neighbor doesn't dine nude. Camille is one of those who peels tomatoes. In Liguria, the Genovese basil grows huge and pungent, with curly leaves. Susan found fresh burrata in Vernazza on her hike. Little clams over pasta shells to start, then the fish, baked with thyme, olive oil, and lemon. The wine is light and easy. Out on the terrace while the fish bakes, Julia empties a bottle into a glass carafe she sets in ice. Quaffable. Don't you love that word? Chris never says quaffable. Everyone showered, wet hair, fresh shorts, and barefoot. Lauro sleeps, snug in his small bed. Julia takes out her phone and searches for a photo. Camille pours and passes the glasses around. Here's my news. Julia holds up a photo of a woman falling straight as an arrow from a cliff into water. She's midway down, toes pointed, arms tight by her sides. They pass it around. Scary, Susan says. That's... who is it? That's not you, Julia. She hands the phone to Camille, who looks closely. That's your bathing suit. Or at least it's blue like yours. I'm leaning into Camille to see. Julia, I know that cliff. Did you jump, you wild thing? I did. I can't explain it. I just found myself climbing up, looking down. I did it. Maybe I wanted to do something to shake me out of the state I've been in since waltzing into town and finding my whole past sitting there in the piazza. It was all unconscious, but... She pauses and sips some wine. Oh, it felt good. Going down, I thought I might fall forever, plunge to the bottom and surface on the other side of the world. It must have been only a moment, but it felt long, fallen. Then to hit the water like a pane of glass. I went way under, but somehow had remembered to take a breath at the last instant. Coming up, up through the water, I had my eyes open. The water was so transparent that I felt I could breathe it like air. The biggest shark, shooting up, breaking the surface, taking a big gulp of air, then swimming to shore. The two women who sat beside my towel applauded. One of them had watched me. She took the picture. I'm glad to have it. Send it to Lizzie. Hell, paste it on your resume. No big deal, you all. Those kids were doing it without thinking. Yes, but you were thinking. I came up feeling washed clean. Well, I'll just say it, spiritually. The fear was intense, but the leap was renewing. I felt buoyant, oxygenated. When I walked out of the water, I shed a skin there. Is it the southern thing, immersion, like baptism in the river? Susan pauses at the kitchen door, the oven timer buzzing. Honey, it means time to move on, Camille says. Again? We just did that. Julia leans against the wall, facing her friends. Julia, Miss Icarus, this looks delicious. I'm starving. Are you all? The Caprese may be the paradigm example of Caprese for all time. The pasta with clams tastes like a milder version of the sea. Julia closes her eyes and savors the briny succulence, wishing briefly that she could give a bite to Chris. I decide to broach the subject. I am going to miss you all. If you travel back, come down to Coral Gables. I think you'd love my mother's kitchen, Julia. My dad cooked. My mom sat at the counter with a mojito and they talked. We listened to Jose Feliciano light my fire over and over. Mexican tile floors, dated maybe by now, but really open to the outdoors, and a screened porch, the only way you can eat outside without mosquitoes lifting you out of your chair and depositing you in an alligator pond. We could grill some great seafood, as good as Italy.
It will be strange without you, even just walking into town in the mornings.
My table at the bar is your table. As it was Margaret's. I venture, isn't your lease up soon? Will you try to extend? Susan speaks unequivocally. I want to stay. I love it here. The adventures we've had. The villa is out of a dream. I've made a garden that defines me, who I am, or who I want to be. Everything's unexpected. I've never had a better experience. Camille, you're modest and most spectacularly successful. You earned it. Now, are we going to acknowledge the dead cat on the table? What do you want to happen?
I've thought about it all day.
I know we've been skirting the subject for a while. I think we were waiting for you to settle into yourself again, Julia. You all know I have a terrible lack of confidence, but the sheer fact of being chosen for the American Museum exhibits keeps knocking down my throwback, once rejected by Arts Council, responses. It's clear to me I'm involved with Rowan, but really, we're going to forge ahead with a relationship that suits us. He has ties in California, business and family. I'd like to visit now and then. What we three decide about the villa isn't going to be an influence or deal breaker. One pleasure of being old, I realize, is that you're free, beyond caring what the neighbors might think.
I'm the same with Chris, Julia says. He's dear, fun, and thoughtful, like no man I've known except my dad. But I do and all that?
No. I was squashed like a frog in the road when I left Wade. I never, ever expected I could love being independent.
Love it. I think a mature love can be different. Kit, you must feel that being with Colin is a freedom, not a binding. I nod. I do. He's my Lux Mundi, light of my world.
Getting off topic. Susan serves the fish and passes around the carafe. Take a vote? Talk more?
I say we buy the villa.
It's not that drastic, speaking as a real estate broker.
Seems drastic to me, Camille laughs, but many things seem drastic to me.
We can always sell if we decide to move on to Thailand. Ask Nicola. They're not making these villas anymore. They're one-offs. They'll always be valuable. Not to talk you into it. The decision is really, really personal.
My divorce settlement will soon be sitting in the bank. I could do it. My dad's keeping the house for Lizzie if she moves back to Savannah. I have my savings, too.
Nicola and Brian said they'll negotiate with Grazia for us. I don't think my Italian is up to it. Susan already has investigated all costs and procedures. She's surprised at how straightforward the process is when there are no required inspections or lawyers involved. Invite Grazia and her aunt to dinner, I advise. Most San Rocco transactions occur with a handshake.
Wait, don't race ahead. I don't want a handshake yet. I'm nervous about this. I should think about it. Talk to Charlie.
Take your time, sweetie. Ha! Take a week. Then we have to decide. I have a toast, if I can remember it.
Get some vino. It's a couple of stanzas from a poem by W.H. Auden. The sense of danger must not disappear. The way is certainly both short and steep, however gradual it looks from here. Look if you like, but you will have to leap. A solitude 10,000 fathoms deep sustains the bed on which we lie, my dear. Although I love you, you will have to leap. Our dream of safety has to disappear. Julia blinks back hot tears, her eyes already red from salt water.
I did leap.
She smiles.
I can leap.
That leap grabs attention in the last stanza, but what strikes me is the profound realization. The lovers lie on 10,000 fathoms of solitude. Yes, we do. Love and friendship are the mitigators. Camille puts her arm around Julia's shoulders. Hey, we can do what we want. Charles rises viscerally through her body, his solid presence. Always the first image to surface, her mouth against his shoulder in bed, the immense security of his body. The image hurts, and she knows why. She is leaving him behind, a colossus in memory, a resin urn of ashes that she must scatter in Spit Creek and among his wild cyclamen. Sleep on it, you three, I say. Gloria Steinem said dreaming is a form of planning. What's the plan? Let's have some of that lemon sorbeto. And Julia, you have gifts to open. Something I meant to say. The air is full of sounds, the sky of tokens. The ground is all memoranda and signatures, and every object covered with hints. So wrote Emerson, and he is right. The world is at all points sentient. That's my religion. Pagan, I guess. I imagine him writing this beside a window in his Concord study on a sweet early autumn day. Maple leaves are falling, and mockingbirds call through the brilliant trees. Someone has left him a gold-lettered book with a gray cover. As a reader, and I suppose cooks, architects, musicians, or furniture makers reach back to their predecessors like this too, I often feel a synaptic connection, beyond meaning, with words I am reading. Not just Mr. Emerson and I'm with you, more, I know you. I read of his sounds, tokens, signatures, as alive today as on that faraway morning. I feel the pulse of I rise up as a poem, Marina Tsetsaeva. Or even reaching way back, flectere sinequio superos aceronta movebo. If I cannot move heaven, I will raise hell. Virgil, Aeneid. The leaping poem by Auden I quoted that night in Cinque Terre came whole right out of my mouth. I was in the ink that flowed from his pen. A solitude 10,000 fathoms deep sustains the bed on which we lie. You feel that at the cellular level, but try to articulate how, and you can't. Writing their Pilgrim's Progress story, I came to know that precise same link with Julia, Camille, and Susan. For how many people do you feel such a connection? Not just, I've got your back and you have mine. I bring this up near the end because I want to express what real friendship is like. Also, it's what I hope for if on a summer day someone reads this story I've told in the yellow-flowered blank book. Not much blank space now, with the vellum spine, now a little soiled. May some voltage run through the words so the reader feels I'm with you. Remember, this book began long ago on a fall day when I was gathering twigs for a fire. As the year carried us in its arc, I wrote our stories. Margaret, still waiting for her book. That the novel is true, not fiction, only I know. Colin hasn't seen a word. Someday, maybe they'll tell me how I did with imagining their thoughts. What have I failed to say? The whole of everything is never told. Henry James. And shouldn't be, I might add. This is where the last pages of the book can be torn out by someone who doesn't want to know the ending. Or perhaps by a collector who is making a book only of last pages. But if I can plant a few small flowers into the crevices of my stone wall, here's where I'll add their whole names, Mary Camille Acton Trowbridge, Susan Ann Frost Ware, Julia Lee Hadley. As a child, Camille was called Mary Camille. Susan was called Suze, and Julia was ever only Julia. Mine? I am Catherine Elizabeth Rain. Kit, since Kathy didn't work out, even at 2 months. San Rocco is unrelentingly beautiful. I didn't say that enough. On the town hall clock face, a tinny skeleton holding a scythe taps at the passing hours, a not subtle reminder that time will overtake everyone. Chiseled below, in 1600, volat ora per orbem. Time wings through the world. At the other end of the piazza, the bank in an ancient palazzo has two clocks. One marks hours, the other minutes. This I prefer. Try to keep both small and large time in mind, I think it means. The inscription there is the old time flies, but in Virgil's more profound original phrase, fugit in re par abile tempus, meaning irretrievable time flees. Time presses against this story, since the women are older than those who usually star in books. Sanroko is made of gold-hued stone, thin Roman bricks, and stuccoed facades with grand windows. Because of the oversized piazza, sky plays an active part. Not chopped or angled off by buildings, the long blue dome completes the whole. Late afternoon, sitting out with your aperitivo, you're aware of sky, not as backdrop, but as the miraculous event of clouds shifting and reforming all day. You're aware of weather coming, sun scraping over stones, and the play of light shadowing and revealing doors, passageways, ghost outlines of former windows and arches. Rays highlight a hand pulling back a curtain, the silver glint of cutlery as Stefano brings out lunch, the electric field around the fur of a ginger cat sleeping by the post office door. How the sky is part of architecture, Colin. Have we ever discussed that? Martyrs and saints were found to have precious stones in their hearts. Rubies, I think, with intaglio images carved into the surface. For those of us who live here, each carries close the jeweled silhouette of San Rocco. Vegetus, the first cry of the newborn. I heard it, and Colin heard it too. For us, Lauro made the sound of the earth whirring around the sun. Lauro, only glimpsed so far. I'm fitting him into the last pages, a delectable bundle of complicated energy with a what's happening look in his mystery blue eyes. Unlike us pale faces, his skin has a dusky cast, Colin's Nicaraguan grandmother sending her love from León, where she rocked in a courtyard surrounded by tropical plants into her 95th year. Lauro's feet, a small wine-stained birthmark on the back of his left heel, as though a wing might have been clipped. Flower from my sack. Who will he be? We don't know yet. I am his mother. They say soldiers dying horribly or tortured prisoners call out for their mothers. I might, too. Forever, I am someone's mother. He's as fated as I. The process of writing a novel. The stone house becomes a transparent house, and I can write on the glass. Coming up for them, Sicily for all, Chris and Julia's research trip extending around the island. They'll end in my favorite Sicilian town, Siracusa. Susan's daughters arriving later for travel in Puglia. They found no parents in China, texting merrily to Susan. Couple of leads, dead ends. Guess we're stuck with you. Friends from home will visit and visit. The oldest agricultural cycles pull toward the olive harvest, the chestnut and mushroom season, the dark of the year, everyone going pazzo over 2 inches of snow in the piazza. Hugh plans to house-sit for us until the new year. He's invited everyone for American Thanksgiving. Camille and Rowan will go to Venice. Camille, how she vaulted over her own expectations. Now she's casting for a new project. I've seen her wonderful rendering of the famous leap into blue water. Julia will travel to see Cleve, then both go to California to visit Lizzie, briefly. A year is not long enough to have cleared out 2 decades of drugs from the brain. Then to meet Chris's son and see the vineyard. They begin the life I know and Margaret knew. Va and torna. Go and return. All good. For now, the gods allow them to play in the freedom of their later years.
Coming up for us, unpacking in my other home, a grand chance for Colin. His pavilion on the ocean, he hopes, will look inevitable and defining, not like some architectural hybrids that smash onto the landscape like meteors. In South Florida, there will be no green nest in the garden for making love. If we tried such folly, we would be sucked dry by mosquitoes, crawled over by lizards, and might disturb the epical snooze of an alligator. The screened porch with a daybed is hidden by banana trees and elephant ears, by the grace of overhead fans and the scent of ginger lilies. Love will happen. Birth control, a new issue. Because I have few friends left in Coral Gables, and Colin will travel to Key West a couple of days a week, I'll teach a writing class at the University of Miami in the spring. Priority, finish Margaret's tribute. Lauro will sit, crawl, walk. Until we return, I will miss my friends in Villa Assunta every day. More to say, but the ink is drying, like a culacino, the circle left by a wet glass on the table. The end belongs to them. My words slide off the page and float over the desk, rearranging into what I meant to say. First night. Where else will the bank have ceiling frescoes of Bacchus in grapevine headdress? He looks lewd, about to tip his glass of wine onto customers standing in line, waiting to deal with the intricacies of withdrawing money. Susan knows she's in for red tape, as her, Julia's, and Camille's money for the house has been wired into her account. 2 hours later, every centesimo has been transferred to Grazia. Yesterday, they sat at the notary office and listened to the endless contract read aloud, a remnant from days when many couldn't read. As of this moment, free and clear, Villa Assunta belongs to Julia, Camille, and Susan. Grazia cried, even though she wanted to sell. Should we always cry when we get what we want? They all went out for celebratory Prosecco after everything was signed, and she cheered, even got a little drunk, then cried again. She'll be coming by later today to pick up the few items she wants. From the big storeroom upstairs, she chose nothing. Susan looks forward to delving into the packed boxes, surely filled not just with musty curtains, but with treasures. The room gives them a new space to invent, but it's destined to become another bedroom for guests and family. Three owners will be juggling the visitor issue for years. When Susan worked at Ware Properties, she had a tradition of sending 3 dozen roses to new owners when they moved in. She ordered red ones for Grazia, and has long-stemmed yellow ones for Villa Assunta. From the garden, she already has vases of her late roses around the house, even in the bathrooms. Julia has dinner underway. Later in the week, a party with Chris, Rowan, all their Italian friends, and the expats to say goodbye to Kit and Colin and to christen the house as theirs. But tonight, just the three of them. Julia's preparing meringues to serve with a berry coulis. Camille organizes the wines and glasses and sets the table with one of Louise's, now their own, linen tablecloths. She has gift sacks of lemon soaps and bath gel for each place. This silver, can you believe it? All ours now. If we ever sell, we should offer it again to Grazia. She might change her mind. Let's don't talk about selling on the day we bought. Susan arranges her massive bouquet of yellow roses.
We've crossed the divide.
Julia whips the whites with fervor.
Forever after, we'll be saying, before we bought, after we bought.
The aromas of baking zucchini tarts and roasting ducks with pears fill the kitchen.
Feels drastic. Exciting.
I'm still nervous, Camille admits. She's looking at her playlist, but doesn't select that favorite Yo-Yo Ma playing Ennio Morricone for fear of breaking down into a torrent of tears. The mission gets to her on a calm day, but on this one of rocketing emotions, no, best not. She chooses opera instead. The three tenors blast forth. This house was meant for listening to great arias.
Oh, I am totally speechless. This is major. Are we geniuses?
Imagine, we've done this. I wish I believed that Aaron is looking down from a cloud admiring us.
Charles would be quite astonished. Can we listen to Georgia? I kind of have to hear it tonight.
Who knows what Wade will think, and who cares?
The syrup-thick lyrics take them back, especially Julia. Susan switches links, and here comes Louis Armstrong. Bright, blessed day, and dark, sacred night.
Let's get ready and celebrate.
Susan dashes upstairs. In their rooms, they dress for dinner. Julia in a metallic gray silk top, Camille in navy linen pants and blouse for the last gasp of summer, Susan already moving into fall in a copper shirt and taupe skirt. They take turns photographing each other on the threshold of the house, remembering when they opened the heavy creaking door almost a year ago and saw clear through to the back window where the linden tree's last leaves blazed yellow in the late evening light. In the photos, each holds up in turn the iron key.
Paper door, Camille says.
Wasn't it a paper door?
In the dining room, under the auspices of yellow roses reflected in a round mirror, and the nun's felicitous fresco, and the great gold-leaf mirror above the fireplace, they pull up their chairs to the table. As they touch glasses, the mirrors catch sparks of light from the clear wine, the clasp in Julia's hair, flickers of candles, the old silverware. Where this story stops, they look into a mirror reflecting a mirror where the story begins and reflects a mirror where the story continues. This is Kimberly Farr. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Women in Sunlight by Frances Mays. This program was directed by Kathy Thornburn, executive producer Orly Moskowitz. Text copyright 2018 by Frances Mays. Production copyright 2018. Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.